Hello everyone and happy Women's Day. We're super excited celebrating today with a very special episode. We have an inspiring guest here today with us, Ufra Mir, a peace psychologist from Kashmir. I'm Clara.
And I'm Leila, and I'm really excited about this episode because Ufra has a lot of amazing insights into peace psychology. She's based in Kashmir, and we just want to encourage you to find out more about the details of the conflict on your own time because we won't be covering them in this episode.
So after spending a few episodes on exploring different topics related to conflict and peace building and different practitioners that are related to this field, we now want to dive a little bit deeper into the field of peace psychology and personal well-being. And we actually have an expert here with us today. This is Ufra, and she's a peace psychologist. She's an expert in a lot of other things as well. I think the best way is she's just going to introduce herself. Welcome, Ufra, to this new episode of Youth Peace Talks. We're super excited to have you here today. Feel free to introduce yourself and tell our audience who you are and what brings you here today.
Hi everyone who's listening. Thank you for having me. And thank you, Clara, for your kind words to begin with. As you mentioned, I'm a peace psychologist. I'm the first one to be doing peace psychology from Kashmir in India and South Asia generally. I work at the intersection of peace building, education, and the science of psychology. So it's a very eclectic approach to look at peace building. I've been very vocal about looking at peace building from the perspective of well-being, wellness, and especially mental health and psychosocial support because of my background and where I come from and where I saw the gap was, because I'm from Kashmir and it's a conflict zone and the conflict has been ongoing for decades now. What I saw in my experience was that, you know, some people were focusing on mental health, psychosocial stuff, and some people were focusing on peace building. But that to me felt like there was a gap in between and that needed to be bridged. So that was my initial motivation to actually explore peace psychology as a field. Peace psychology is not a really new field. It's actually quite an old field. I think after the World War II happened, some psychologists were concerned about, you know, what are the kinds of attitudes, behaviors, for instance, that contribute to wars and violence, and simultaneously, what are the kinds of behaviors, the systematic approach to things, or attitudes or skills and techniques that can promote more of positive peace building, not just the end of war, for instance. So that has always intrigued me because I came from Kashmir. I saw a lot of pain and conflict around me. So my motivation was, you know, what do I do about my own pain also that I've felt as a Kashmiri? So peace psychology was this instant thing that kind of happened to me when I was in high school and I had taken psychology for the first time. And I also started getting trained in conflict resolution skills. So it was kind of natural for me to think that, you know, like what would happen if I merged the two fields, psychology and peace building. At that point, I didn't even know it was a field. I just got to know about it much later when I was in college and other things. But the whole idea of peace psychology kind of came to me when I was in high school in India. I went to this international high school where it was mostly based on the peace building ideology. We had students from many countries of the world. The curriculum was IB, International Baccalaureate. But beyond that, there was a lot of focus on change making, leadership, you know, contributing to the communities we come from. So that is where I think I had a lot of self-transformation, and I started thinking about how can I also contribute to the bigger world out there. Since my childhood, I was always interested and kind of had this insight that, you know, I'm not here just to, you know, do regular things. I need to also contribute. So a lot of my teenage kind of went into thinking about or reflecting about what is the meaning of my existence? How can I contribute to the world? So that is where peace psychology started. And then I went abroad in my college and university space. I started exploring it more seriously. I also started an initiative by GAM, which also works on the ideology of peace psychology. Now I also run an international center for peace psychology. Would you like me to explain a bit more about peace psychology, or was that your second question?
Yeah, that would be great. I'd love to hear what your definition of peace psychology is.
Sure. So as I said, peace psychology is actually one of the subfields in psychology. You know, psychology is really vast. We have so many subfields, from clinical psychology to developmental psychology. Now you even have aviation psychology, forensic psychology. So there's a broad spectrum of things, and peace psychology also happens to be one of the subfields in psychology. And in APA, in American Psychological Association, there's a certain division dedicated to the psychology of peace and, you know, conflict, and they call it peace psychology. How I understand it is, because a lot of my peace psychology work has been about, it's evolved, I think, with me. I think I've also evolved in this journey. In the past decade, I've been working on ground especially. So I can tell you how I understand it. So for me, it is really about positive peace building. I believe that conflicts are of different levels and forms. You know, it's not just political conflict. We have conflicts at an intra level, at inter levels, community levels, in relationships. And a lot of people sometimes think about peace as a product and as a futuristic activity. You know, it'll happen one day, when this will happen. So I don't look at it that way. I do believe that we will end up with problems and chaos and stressors, even if we were to, you know, live on moon, for instance, because such is the nature of human existence. So if problems are not going to go away, what we need to instead do is focus on our resilience, on coping mechanisms, on skills that will actually help us deal with chaos in a much more constructive way. So that is what a lot of my work is focused on, how to help people take charge of their narratives in situations where they feel completely helpless. So in conflict zones, for instance, when you're day in and day out living in constant fear, you're living in situations where abnormal has become your daily normal. So, you know, there's a lot of general learned helplessness, there's hopelessness, you feel obviously powerless. And a lot of trauma, fears affect your own psychology, they affect your physical health, they affect everything you do, basically. Like in Kashmir, for instance, when you go out of your house in the morning, you don't know if you'll come back alive. And that's become so subconscious, you know, people don't even really think about it every day now. So there is also a lot of numbness as well. So for me, it is important that even in these situations, people firstly create windows of resilience, of some calm, of, taking charge of things in some way. And for me, art is really important in peace building. So a lot of my work is actually based on experiential workshops, on different modules of peace psychology that I've created. I use a very eclectic module, which has aspects of mental health, psychosocial support, how to use art in peace building or to understand conflicts, existential psychology, spiritual psychology. Emotional well-being is something I've worked a lot on in Kashmir and other places, empathy, for instance, and also trying to understand it from, you know, self-transformation perspective, but also as a system, like what can you do, change making, leadership development, for instance. So I use a very eclectic module. As I said, most of my work has been through experiential workshops that I do with individuals and groups and communities. But I have also been doing it with individuals, and now with technology, a lot of, that it's an important medium because there are a lot of young people there. So I also use that as a way to do some of my work. And it has, my work in Kashmir has been completely voluntary. I don't charge for anything I do here, because this is, the situation here has been, it's only been worse. So this is my way of kind of contributing to whatever peace building I can do. I mean, it is, there's also a valid question. A lot of times people ask me, how do you build peace in a place where there's an ongoing conflict? Because in some places where the conflict is over, then people do kind of post-conflict recovery stuff. In Kashmir, that's not possible. So it has its own challenges. But again, my ideology of peace psychology comes from the fact that peace is a process, and we need to we need to keep creating windows and spaces for positive peace building on a daily basis. We can't wait for future to happen. And what you do in your present is actually something that creates your future accordingly.
I really like your vision. It's really beautiful. Instead of seeing peace as a future product that you're going to reach one day, really making it into the present and the process. It's, yeah, you explained it very eloquently. And also, I love the use of art in peace building. It's really beautiful. Could you maybe give some examples of how you go about in your work, like the kind of workshops that you do? Because I remember watching your TED Talk and you explained a lot of your work in there. By the way, listeners, I recommend you listen to the TED Talk as well, because it was really good.
We're going to make sure we're going to link it in the notes.
Yes, definitely.
Thank you. So I work at the intersection of education. For me, has always been, I think, a great medium to do a lot of peace education work or peace building work, because I started doing things very seriously when I was a teenager. I think when you're a teenager, you know, you can, there's a lot of space to make or break things. And if you give people, young people, the space they need at that point, they can contribute very positively to the society. So a lot of my work has been with young people, with women, with orphans. In Kashmir, I've also worked with half widows, which is a community of women who don't actually know whether or not their husbands are alive. Most of the time they get killed, but they don't know that for sure. So I also try to work with artists and journalists, creating small, safe communities where they can also, you know, interact with each other in that space, because that is really important as a form of psychosocial support. But obviously, it needs to be facilitated by a professional, because there are a lot of unethical practices also happening. COVID kind of highlighted some of these things for us in terms of mental health. Otherwise, you know, you would sometimes see random people from other professions also kind of doing mental health work, which has a lot of severe consequences. So a lot, as I said, my work has been on experiential workshops that I do with individuals, with these groups, with different kinds of people. In Kashmir, I also introduced some of my peace psychology modules in some schools. So it was more geared towards peace education, or how to create like balanced environment in the school itself. At community level, you know, I've been doing this work with different kinds of people, different kinds of groups. I would say, I think at a system level, I've not done a lot of work yet, because it is difficult to kind of work at a systemic level in Kashmir, especially given the situation that is over here. So I focused more on what was in my control and what could I contribute at, because obviously at an advocacy level, I talk about what can happen or should happen, but that's not so much in my control. So I've kind of designed and devised programs accordingly. So in Kashmir, as I mentioned, my work has been voluntary. I do this work in my free time. I also have a full-time job in Myanmar right now. I'm working with a European peace building organization there. I'm technically based there, but because of COVID and the current situation there, I'm back here. And beyond that, I also mentor some organizations, local organizations here. I mentor some individuals. And as I said, in my free time, I also do some work through my nonprofit PEGAM and the International Center for Peace Psychology, through which I'm trying to also create more collaborations with organizations abroad, like who are working in peace building or educational institutions, because one of my bigger goals is to also create more curriculum around peace psychology and do more advocacy, because it's still a very unexplored kind of a field. Like even here, I think after talking about it for 10 years, now people kind of recognize it a bit. But I think there's still a lot more that needs to be done in that direction.
Wow, that is so impressive. Next to all this, you still have time to come and talk to us about this. We're so happy to have you here. This sounds like you have a lot on your plate and you really like to be very active in a lot of different fields. But what I'm also interested in is, I know that you're also using social media and technology to reach out, and especially reach out to young people that are maybe a bit more difficult to approach and access. Maybe you can explain a little bit on how you do this or why you do this, and maybe also how you see the benefits and the challenges in this.
I think, you know, technology is here to stay whether we like it or not. And that we need to use hybrid approach to future peace building. The technology is here to stay. So I don't like social media as much because I don't think it's a very safe space. I think it's not designed that way. Let's just be honest about that. So one of my bigger goals is to also make social media a safer space for people to be, because there's so much focus on this grand portrayal of life on Instagram, for instance, and everybody wants to portray that they're having an amazing life all the time, which is not true. So I, for instance, talk a lot about my emotional journey, like if I'm feeling low about certain things, if I'm not feeling good about certain things, I feel it's important for me to talk about that, because otherwise people will just assume that I'm having such a grand life, you know, because that's how social media is, especially some of these applications where focus is so much on the good parts of your life and not so much about the other things about your life, which are actually really important to talk about, because that's what makes you human. You can't be happy all the time. That's not possible at all. So a lot of my work on social media is about raising awareness about emotional well-being, our emotions, why are they important in any kind of work, but obviously from a peace building lens as well. And I use it also as a space to do a lot of mental health, psychosocial support work, where I share resources, tips. I'm a peace psychologist, so I don't do, let's say, clinical psychology work. So if people reach out to me for that kind of support, I have a list of professionals from Kashmir and outside who I, refer them to. Or simply creating dialogue and conversations about these things, because there's still so much of stigma around these topics. And I think what is important is to also be very conflict sensitive. So in terms of context sensitivity, your language and the approach changes from context to context. So in Kashmir, instead of talking too much about, let's say, conflict resolution, what I realized was because of the ongoing mental health crisis here due to the ongoing conflict, that is one thing that's really important. So instead of talking about conflict resolution, intentionally focus a lot more on emotional well-being, on mental health, psychosocial support, because there's still so much of stigma related to that. Yet I think in the recent past, especially in Kashmir, youngsters especially are reaching out. So I get like 5-10 messages every day on different platforms of social media. So in my free time, I also offer psychological first aid talk to them, and accordingly kind of refer them to the more specialized support they would need. But as I said, I think my bigger goal on social media and as well on ground is also to create these safe communities, safe space where people can be, instead of debate, can they have a dialogue with each other? Can we have deeper conversations around things? Because as I said, you know, social media is not necessarily designed very empathetically. Everybody's kind of, and there's so much anonymity on social media that it's easy to have hate speech, for instance, or you know, all those things. So I try to use it very authentically as I can, because that's one of the most important values in my life, and I encourage other people to do the same.
I really admire that. That's really courageous of you as well, because it demands a lot of vulnerability in a very open space. So that's very admirable. I wonder how you would define well-being yourself, because having all this focus on inner peace and inner well-being, it must also be difficult for you also to take care of yourself when you're worried about everyone else around you. But do you have a definition or a vision of what well-being is?
Not so much of a definition, but definitely a vision. For me, well-being needs to be seen from a very holistic perspective. It's not just from mental health perspective. Overall, I think well-being needs to be understood in a very, you know, eclectic manner. So for instance, in my work, I use this wellness wheel, which talks about different dimensions of wellness, you know, from intellectual well-being to emotional well-being to, let's say, environmental well-being, spiritual well-being, mental well-being. So I think all of these things, when they are in balance with each other, that's when we can say somebody is, you know, doing well. But because of this whole notion about physical health, like we usually associate well-being with physical health, like if you're eating well, if you're going to gym, for instance, we say, okay, you know, this person is doing well. But there are other invisible things that really, really affect you and your overall well-being as well. So if you're not, let's say you're physically well, but you're not doing so well mentally or emotionally, it has a direct impact on your overall well-being, including your physical well-being, your intellectual space, your spirituality. So I work with that. I've been using that a lot in my emotional well-being module as well. So that's how I understand it. And I think it is important to also use it, not just, I think in medical field also, it is very important. In any kind of well-being related field, it's important to look at these things from a very multidimensional perspective. Because in the end, no two humans are the same. You know, you need to sometimes, let's say a person having a migraine, it could probably be because of some issue in their stomach, or the other way around as well. So we need to understand people in their context, from where they come from, their past history, you know, all sorts of things. So that's what my way of actually understanding well-being. And that's why in peace psychology, I have a lot of focus on well-being as well. And with time, I have been busy, you know, I have been doing a lot of things, especially when I came back to Kashmir, nobody knew about peace psychology. So I had to do a lot of work on my own as an individual. There was no support system. There were no mentors here. I was lucky to have some back in the college or US when I was there. So I started doing a lot of work to create awareness. I still do a lot of work around awareness, because even today there's so much of misinformation and you know, unawareness about even basics of mental health. People still don't know exactly who to go to. So even something that can be managed with, let's say, psychotherapy or clinical psychology, people, because they don't know, they end up going to a psychiatrist. Or sometimes people actually need to go to a psychiatrist, but they end up with a counseling psychologist. So I do a lot of, you know, awareness programs around these things. And in that process, especially as a woman peace builder, it takes a toll on you. Because you also, I, for instance, in my case, I come from a Muslim conservative society. So everything is, you know, questionable, like the way I dress up, the way I put my hair, who I'm meeting, where I'm going. So it also limits your options. And on top of that, if you are, as a woman, you know, you mentally, or sometimes it becomes so subconscious to us that even thinking about self feels selfish. Sometimes in these societies, there is no concept of self-care. Like I know a lot of women in my mother's generation, sometimes they don't know how to relax because they think it's a waste of time. So I also kind of, you know, grew up with that kind of mentality and psychology. And later it became important for me to realize how important it is to practice self-empathy and self-care. Because otherwise it takes a toll on you. Women are at the forefront of a lot of things, and you cannot function from an empty vessel, as cliched as it sounds, but it has become so important for me. Cognitively, I've known the importance of self-care for a long time because I studied psychology, but it's been so recent that I'm trying to practice it more and more. And it's still so difficult because, as you said, you know, when you are so focused on others healing their pain, their resilience, you tend to forget yourself. But at the same time, it is so important to focus on yourself, create those windows of healing from time to time for yourself so that you can also be more effective for others. So I'm trying to, I do some basics, you know, very simple things. I sometimes, because I'm really connected to art, so I do some artwork for myself. I sometimes, now I'm trying to consciously also trying to take breaks in between sometimes. Or I'm learning to say no. I think that's really, really important, because otherwise you feel like you know, you have to save the world. I think that is one of the things that a lot of people, especially in peace building field, they feel like they need to save the world all the time. So it's important to keep in mind that you can only do so much. So letting go of the lot of other things that you cannot do, I think that's been one of my learnings from all of these years.
That was an amazing answer. You gave us so much to think about, and it raised a lot of questions and comments in my head. But I also really like that you included these very practical tips, and I hope that can help some of the listeners as well. I think it's always so important to keep these things in mind. One thing that I was thinking about, because I'm actually studying policy at the moment, so my mind is geared in that way. And I know that you said you haven't worked yet on a systemic level, partly because of the situation in Kashmir. But I wonder if you kind of envision a shift in like more structural policies towards a more, I don't know what the word would be, but if we included a lot more self-awareness and more sensitivity in political structures or policies, do you see that happening, or do you see how we could implement this and how it would be useful? This is a very vague question. I'm sure you'll have
it's
a great
not,
answer.
It's
anyway.
Actually a very important question. So we have these conversations now, for instance, in my part of the world about, let's say, mental health. Is it inclusive or not? Or is mental political? You know, a lot of times people think that whatever is happening with them mentally, it's just their business. It's no one else's business. But mental health is as political as it is personal. And it's the same thing with, you know, peace psychology or any kind of psychology, well-being, mental health related stuff. I think obviously there needs to be a lot more work that needs to be done in terms of policies, advocacy, and a very infrastructural level change. In India, obviously, there's still so much of stigma around mental health. Let's say it's not as inclusive as it should be. So, you know, there are different kinds of groups. They need different kinds of specific support. So the conversation in general is kind of shifting now from, let's say, before it was just mental health. Now it's about inclusive mental health. So policies do impact a lot at that level. But I think what is more important is, again, this hybrid approach of policies and ground level works. When you take in what you understand from the ground reality, the needs on ground, and you feed it into the system where the change can happen at a, you know, a large scale. I think that is the most effective approach. Obviously, it's not the easiest one. It doesn't always happen also in the real world. But it is important. I think systemic change can shape a lot of things faster. But for that to also happen, the things on ground also need to keep happening. So that's why, like in Kashmir, for instance, a lot of my work has been with individuals and communities. But in other places in South Asia where I work, it's a little different. There I actually work more on empowering organizations and trying to see how can we create positively to the policy level change, for instance. So the approach, because Kashmir is a different space, you have to, again, be very conflict sensitive and choose the approach accordingly. In some places where there is probably more openness towards it, you need to obviously shift your focus there. But one thing that's also important is to realize that you may not always be in the space to talk about, let's say, a policy level change for whatever reason. Sometimes you also have to be concerned about your own safety and security. But how do you take whatever your learning is from the field and feed it to, let's say, stakeholders or important members of the society so that they can then take it forward to a place where some sort of policy level change can happen?
Wow. This is some really, really good insights and a pretty good answer to a quite complex question. I wish we could just keep up this conversation forever, because you have so much interesting, so many interesting things to say and so many good insights. We are nearing the end of the conversation though, and we have a few last questions for you prepared. First of all, I'd be really interested to hear what goal do you have for your career in the near future? So is there anything that you would like to achieve this year, or is there anything that's on your to-do list for this year where you really see hope that this is going to happen soon for you career-wise?
So a couple of things. I've become a very process journey oriented person. So I don't really worry too much about where I'll be tomorrow. Mm-hmm. I know I'll be doing some sort of peace psychology work. I don't know where though, like, because a lot of things that have happened in my life, once I kind of gave up that control and surrendered to the design of the universe, they just kept happening. All I know at this point is that where I am, I need to contribute in the best possible way. And where I am is where I'm needed. This is what needed to be done. So I have this because I follow my intuition very, very strongly. This is that's the kind of satisfaction I live with. This is not an easy field. There are days when I go through existential crisis as well. And I ask myself if the work I'm doing is even contributing or is it even meaningful. But at the end of the day, because of the people I've worked with, where I've seen spaces of change and transformation happen, I strongly believe in the work I do. And I believe that wherever I am is wherever I'm needed. But at the same time, I've been wanting to write a book about my work in peace psychology for the past 10 years now. I always would question myself and ask if I know enough to write, and then I realize I'll never know enough to write, so it's okay. So I'm kind of, I'm hoping that I'll publish a book or two in the next couple of years. That's one of the bigger goals. And with my Center of Peace Psychology as well, I would like to contribute more to that through local and international collaborations with universities, with organizations. So those are a couple of big, big goals in my life, the professional goals in my life right now.
Yeah, I'd love to read a book from you.
I was just going to say, yeah. I don't doubt.
It makes me really nervous. I don't know if I'm at that space, but I think it is also important for people to just read what's happening in some other part of the world.
I agree with Leila. I definitely get this book and would be so curious to read that. Speaking about books, do you have any recommendations for our listeners? Maybe some books on the topic, documentaries or podcasts that you really like to listen to yourself, whether it's on the topic or maybe also something that just helps you with your well-being?
So on the podcast, I listen to Sam Harris a lot. He's this neuroscientist, amazing, amazing person. I may not always agree with everything he has to say, but I love his way of thinking and rationalizing things and a lot of good work. He does a lot of good work around free will, about neuroscience and other things. So that really fascinates me. So if you haven't yet, you can always see it for yourself. One of the books, I'm just looking at my books on my table. One book that I really, really love, a couple of books that I really love and go back to is firstly a book by Viktor Frankl called, it's called Man's Search for Meaning. He was a psychiatrist who went through a lot of things himself and created this logotherapy. It is really about like when you are in conflict situations or, you know, the kind of really in really, really war-like situations or when you have nothing to hope for, how do you still survive and find meaning in life? I think that's really relevant for our times as well. The other book I really like, George Orwell and his 1984 or Animal Farm is something that I really appreciate deeply. And whatever he's talked about in 1984 is basically the scenario in the world right now.
Those are great recommendations. And I agree with Sam Harris. He's fascinating. And he's so eloquent in the way he explains
so
everything.
Much.
He'll have these really long sentences with really complex ideas. But
so I used to work with a conflict management center a few years ago. And we used to do a lot of work around higher order thinking skills and critical thinking, creative thinking. So that's where Sam Harris got introduced to me. And I've been following him ever since.
Some really good tips and some books that are going to go on my to-read list for sure. The last question for you, Ufra, today. What is your vision for the future? This is an incredibly broad question, but I'm sure you have something to say about this. You have some thoughts that you would like to share. And yeah, I'd be really curious to hear.
I'm really concerned about the state of affairs or, you know, the world in general and where we're heading. I think this empathy is decreasing day by day with that use of, I'm not going to say that it's technology's fault. I think we also need to contribute in ways where we can make, let's say, technology or social media much more safer, a space for everybody. But in general, I think, you know, because we live in this day and age where sometimes it's a time of, you know, clicks and links. Sometimes you put up links and you think your job is done. I think it is really important to hold on to some important values like empathy, imagination. Imagination is so important in peace building. If you can't imagine it, you can't do it. And imagine is my favorite word. I really love John Lennon's song as well. It gives me hope. So, you know, and philosophical understanding about things rather than just quick fixing everything out there. I think there is a lot of unthought through action out there. We all need to develop a habit of reflection in our personal lives as well. I think that really contributes to the communities as well that we are a part of. So my vision for future, obviously, because I am in peace building, and no matter how bad the situation is, I would hope for a more resilient, more empathetic, more just and more peaceful world. But I know it sounds very flowery when I say that, and that is where it becomes so important that we as individuals reflect deeply about these things and see how can we contribute to these things in making a world a better space. Because I do believe in this kind of process of change making. Like if individuals do something about it, it, I think, creates this ripple effect that does definitely contribute to the bigger kind of change making happening around the world.
Wow, amazing answer. I love everything you've just said. This podcast has given me so much energy because I really relate to all your ideas and your vision. So it's really great to listen to you. And I don't think it sounds that flowery. I think this is part of this whole, we need to shift global consciousness in a way so that we don't see these things as flowery and cheesy, that, you know, reflection, as you're saying, should be a norm and should be what everyone's doing all the time. Yeah, I think that's a great vision for the future.
Just adding one last thing, I think we also need to realize that social media is just a part of our lives. It's not the heart of our lives. I think a lot of us get affected by that because we start finding credibility and validity of our existence from the number of likes and, you know, all of that on social media. So it's also important to use technology and social media as a medium, but also do so very mindfully and also kind of have some non-technology time for ourselves, because the kind of energy I get from people when I work on ground is always so different. It's amazingly beautiful. But I also recognize how important technology is. So there needs to be a balance. I think balance is always the key word in everything we do.
Those are some beautiful words to finish off with. And I want to say thank you so much again for joining us and for sharing all your visions and your insights. It's been really, really interesting to hear about your work and everything you have to say about peace building and inner peace, well-being, all of it. I encourage everyone who's listening to go check out Ufra's channels on all the social medias that we've mentioned and use these social medias in a constructive way.
In a mindful way.
Exactly.
Thank you
so much. And I hope you have a lovely day. And thank you to our listeners for listening. And we'll see you soon.
Thanks so much for being such a patient audience. No, it was lovely. Thanks so much for having me again.
So now we've reached the end of the first season of Youth Peace Talks. Thanks to everyone who's been following us on this very exciting journey.
Yeah, it's been a really exciting journey. We found out about peace journalism, about creating an NGO, about the implementation of the Colombian Peace Accord, and of course about peace psychology today. And we've covered different regions in the world. There's been Kosovo, Bosnia, the Netherlands, Colombia, and Kashmir.
Yeah, hopefully you've been enjoying getting to know all these peace builders and been inspired by their activities and their work. But very exciting news, we've already started to record the second season of our podcast, which is going to be on the topic of
the role of language in peace building. Is going to be a really exciting
season with a lot of different guests, and something to look forward to is that we'll have two episodes in different languages, one in Arabic and one in Hebrew.
So hopefully you'll tune back in for this, and take care until then.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.